this year, thousands of American tourists will go to Europe. Fine. But one of them has my credit card. In Rome, they will gaze on the ruins of the Forum, where at the base of great Pompey's statue, which all the pile wagon blood, great Caesar fell. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen. In Paris, they will stand in the Place de la Concorde and fancy that they hear again the men from Marseille sing, "Marchons, marchons." And in Athens, they will stand on Mars Hill, where St. Paul preached a famous sermon which had all the inspirational force of a four-day-old bagel. Now, like us, the people of the Bible were also fascinated by ancient civilizations which were as far removed in time from them as Greece and Rome are from us. In Babylon, which we call Iran, they gazed upon a great terraced earthwork, tiered like a wedding cake, which reached right up into the clouds, right up into heaven. It's still there. It's known as the Tower of Babel, the tower in Iran. And then the top of this crumbling edifice were the ruins of an old temple, probably a shrine to the moon god. And as they looked at that old crumbling edifice so large, they heard folk tales about it which had circulated for years and years. And then they took what they heard, and they took what they saw, and they used it to express a faith that is the foundation of our faith today. You know how the story starts. And the whole earth had one language and one speech. And immediately we shake our heads. We know that the human race never had a common universal language. On one side of the world, when they meet, they'll say to each other, "Jingza." On the other side of the world, when they meet, they'll say, "Wheel, wheel, Algana, what do the next again?" Totally different peoples saying different words and different languages. To understand the first, you have to learn Chinese. To understand the second, you've got to be gifted. There was never a common language. But of course, all the ancient storytellers are not literalists. They think in pictures. They think in metaphors. And what our storyteller is giving us is a metaphor about the oneness of the whole earth. As John Donne said, no man is an island. And that's right, isn't it? We are all interconnected. But when you washed this morning, did you not use soap, a substance invented by the ancient Gauls? When you shaved, were you not imitating a ceremony first developed by the ancient priests of Sumer? When you put on a suit, was not that a form of dress native to the Asiatic steppes? And if you added a tie like Mark, isn't that the remnant of a shoulder shawl from a 7th century? And so in the end, says the storyteller, they were so much at sixes and sevens that they left off building the city. Or, to put it another way around, things were no longer tickety-boo, which is an original Scottish song, or you may have it as a later Danny Kaye one if you really wish. What the biblical writer is telling us is that it's not humankind's ignorance that threatens his community with disaster. It's his knowledge. It's the powers with advanced technology, North Korea, Iran, who may pose the real threat to the survival of our fragile globe. He's saying, in this parable, in this picture, in this metaphor, he's saying, could it be that we have too big a stake in technological progress and too small a stake in spiritual things? Too big a stake in the Tao and too small a stake in flowers? Too big a stake in dividends and too small a stake in family conversation? Bible sees all too clearly that the problem of our earth lies not in our heads, it lies in our hearts. Not in our skills, but in our priorities. Not in whether we can build cities, but in whether we can create communities. When we come to the end of life's journey, will we say, I wish I had spent more time in the office? Or will we say, I wish I had spent more time with my loved ones? I say it again, the danger lies not in our weaknesses, but in our strengths. Think of that in the community of faith. Here is a church, and it takes seriously the Bible as the cradle of the Christ. That's a great strength, for people are hungry for a saving word that comes from the beyond. But let that church beware, lest the Bible become an end in itself, an uncomfortable word which they make comfortable and domesticate to keep the religious folk comfortable. Sunday mornings are not about sweet Jesus. They're about following him through thick and thin when the values of our society are otherwise. 4 years a church which prides itself on its music. That's a great strength, because religion was sung before it was ever spoken, and the heart must be won over before the head can be persuaded. But let it also remember those who have no song in their hearts, for life muted their joy a long time ago. And the same is true, I think, on a personal level. I love my children. I want the very best for them. But can I learn to step back and allow them to make their own mistakes? Can I let them be themselves, even when I think I know better, and I do? If I believe the ups and downs of life are the raw material out of which God fashions our souls for heaven, can I embrace the dark moments of life as well as the bright ones? Can I accept the tears as well as the smiles? Can I accept the sad farewells as well as the bright morning greetings? Our strengths, our weaknesses. And finally, a word to you who have been confirmed today. We're very proud of you. We think you're great. You bring new vigor and new vitality and service is not your graduation so that you can move on. It's your confirmation so that you can move in. So listen carefully to what I say. Even those of us who have been part of the community of faith for a long time know that the church can sometimes be very boring and stuffy. Your calling today is to change that, to bring a new spirit into our midst. Personally, I'm not terribly sure that doctrine matters all that much, though please don't tell Cindy that. What does matter is that you keep reminding us of what the kind of progress that we really ought to be looking for, not trying to build the city so much, but trying to build compassion and care. It's the glory of your time that we have found the resources to conquer space, yet failed to find the resources to conquer inner city poverty and suburban loneliness. It's the glory of your time that you have far more things than your grandparents ever dreamed of. Yet we have failed, yet you will also inherit a society where there are more single parents and more battered babies and more senseless killings. It's the glory of your time that we have, that you have immediate communication at your fingertips. But too often marriages are less stable and families are less contented and relationships are less satisfying. Don't misunderstand me. There is a glory in your age that your grandparents didn't have. The glory is real enough. I'm not suggesting we go back to the horse and the buggy. I'm not suggesting we go back to the wick lamps and the bonnets of yesteryear. The good old days were not always good. But I am saying that the counterpart of the story about Babel in the Old Testament is the story of Pentecost in the New Testament. And there the storyteller also is using pictures. He's using vivid images of fire and wind to tell of a new kind of people. A people, he says, who were fired up within. They were not crazies. They weren't neurotics. They're not even drunk. Peter says, they can't be drunk. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning and the pubs don't open. Is happening is that they are possessed by a new spirit which fills their mouths with song and their hearts with gladness.